News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes with you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Remember, next Sunday, not only will we have Hometown Heroes for you at 4 in the afternoon, but that also marks the day that the second annual Heroes of the Valley fundraiser will be held in downtown Fresno. To get your tickets now, go to heroesofthevalley.com or call 323-9226 in the 559 area code. That's just the second year that there's been a fundraiser for the great treasure that's in downtown Fresno, known as the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. And my guest on today's program is a man who knows that place very well because he's a longtime volunteer at the Veterans Memorial Museum. He's a native of Cicero, Illinois, which if you know your Al Capone, you may have heard a little bit about Cicero. Frank Hoker joins us today. And Frank, I imagine you heard about Al Capone at a very young age there in Cicero.
He was one of the guys that everybody either kind of looks up to or hated. It was a mixture of love and hate because of his connection with a mob, with bootleggers, with the booze, and also the fact that it put the town on the map.
It sure did. It was just a little-known suburb of Chicago until that point. Should I ask you which side of the fence you're on that, if you hated him or loved him? I understand at the time he did a lot of great things for the community, that he put on fireworks shows for kids, and maybe if you didn't grasp the whole nature of organized crime, you might have thought he was a nice guy.
Well, I'll tell you what, it was during the Prohibition, it was also during the Depression, and so there was kind of a mixture of several things going on. Not so much the Prohibition, because everybody kind of ignored that, but as you said, he did do a lot of charitable work. In some strange ways, he was very charitable to the church. I don't know why that is, whether that's a mafia tradition to be part of the church or what have you, but it seemed like that was part of what his background was. And the other part of it was, as I recall, they used to say that Chicago had a very big crime element, but because Al Capone lived in Cicero, he made sure that that town was kept clean. The police chief made sure that the criminals stayed in Chicago and stayed out of his hometown of Cicero. So it was a nice town to live in.
You were a beneficiary of that
exact
phenomenon. Now, I didn't have you on to talk about Al Capone. I had you on today because of your service in World War II and after that in Korea. Frank is an ex-prisoner of war, and we're going to talk about how he became a prisoner of war, how long he got to be in the air in the U.S. Army Air Corps before that, and how long he spent as a prisoner of war, also his experiences in the air over Korea in the early 1950s, and what he's been doing since, including his efforts at the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno. But first of all, Frank, let's talk about how you ended up in the service. You weren't in Chicago anymore. You moved out west to California. Where were you when you heard about the Pearl Harbor attack? Because that seems to be a defining moment in every World War II veteran's life.
Well, actually, it was kind of a peculiar day. My dad had a bakery in Los Angeles, and Sunday morning was my day to be in the shop with a mop and a bucket and washing the floors and making sure the place was clean for Monday morning. And I was listening to the radio while I was doing my mopping, and they broke into the music part of the program to announce that airplanes were attacking Wahoo. At that time, nobody seemed to know where Wahoo was or what it was, except they gradually began to give more information. And at that time, I was 17. I had been preparing to try to get in the Air Corps because I had grown up reading World War I books about the flyers from the, the war to end wars. And I always thought I'd like to be a military flyer. So this is going to be maybe an acceleration for my getting into the Air Corps.
And when you got in, that's what you wanted to do. You were attempting to become a pilot, and you took some steps in that direction,
exactly,
right?
Exactly so. In those days, you didn't get drafted into the Air Corps. You had to go through several hoops. First of all, I had to get three letters of commendation or recommendation that I would be a good candidate to get in. I had to get my parents' signature that they would allow me to go, and then I had to go down and apply and, you know, practically beg to get in. And, you know, even after Pearl Harbor, you still, there were the two phases. One, get drafted, and you had to go whether you wanted to or not. And those guys who were like me, who wanted to get in, they were afraid that the war would be over before they got in. So you had the two aspects of it. One, I don't want to miss this big action. So that was my big thing was to get in before it was over.
And at what point did your dream of becoming a pilot turn out not to be what was actually going to happen for you? Because that was your goal, and for a lot of people, they look back on things like that as a blessing in disguise. But you didn't get to be a pilot. Tell us why that was and where it took you next.
Well, I went through a basic training at, actually here in Fresno. I was brought into the old fairgrounds that had been made into a Japanese relocation center. I don't want to call it a concentration center because it's not a concentration camp, but
that was your first time in Fresno?
First time in Fresno.
So here's a guy from Chicago and L.A. What'd you think of Fresno at the time?
It was pretty neat. It was a neat little town, and the people were very friendly here. When I got my first pass, it was just a kind of a revelation that if you wanted to get a ride, all you did was stand out on the street in your uniform, and somebody came by, stopped, picked you up, and took you where you wanted to go. So it was, to me, it's a fantastic town. I'm surprised I wound up here again after all those years.
You mean you don't do that in Fresno anymore? You don't put on your uniform?
See that. No. But
so you had your basic training here.
I went through basic training here in Fresno. Then I was classified at Santa Ana, and I was designated to go into pilot training. So my first phase of it was at Santa Maria, which was a civilian air base ran by Alan Hancock from, I guess, the USC school. And there we were not in barracks. We were in little cottages. It was kind of strange. We had linoleum on the floors. When we went to the mess hall, they had four men to a table. They had tablecloth, little waitresses who brought our meals to us. This was not the Army as I recall it.
Wow.
And we flew in the Stearman, the PT-13s, which was the biplane, which was so much like World War One that I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. Went through that, graduated from primary school, was sent to Marana, Arizona, where we went to what they called basic training, and there we flew the BT-13. Which is a more powerful aircraft. I think it's 450 horsepower, something like that. There we learned to do navigation, learned to do formation flying, night flying, and radio. And that was like the middle stage. And the last stage was to go to the advanced school, which would be either a single-engine or twin-engine planes. And I wanted to be a fighter pilot, so they sent me to Luke Air Force Base in Arizona at Phoenix, and that's where I met my Waterloo. I flew the plane about six times, made about six different approaches and landings, and the instructor said, I don't think you're going to cut it, young man. And I wound up being reassigned to navigation school in Texas.
Was that a hard thing for you to swallow at the time?
Well, it kind of dashed my dream because I wanted to be flying the plane. I didn't want to be a passenger. But as I got in the navigation school, that turned out to be pretty great because I enjoyed learning about celestial navigation, learning about all the things that go with being a navigator. I had a mechanical background sort of when I was in college before school, before being in the military. And so the mathematics part of navigation was fun. I enjoyed learning celestial navigation, to learn the stars, being able to fly a plane, not fly a plane, but navigate by shooting the stars and finding out where I'm at. That kind of was a neat thing. And then when I finally graduated from navigation school and was assigned to a bomber crew, I met nine other guys who were just terrific guys. And so it was pretty good after that. I kind of got over the fact that I wasn't the pilot. It was okay.
Well, and you're here with us today, so I know it's all worked out okay, and we're thankful for that. Let me ask you one thing. You were on a B-24 crew, and obviously B-24s were in the Pacific and in Europe. Were you glad that you were eventually sent to Europe, knowing that you grew up in Chicago only speaking Czech? That was your first language, not even English. Knowing what Hitler had done to the Czech people, did that maybe add to your motivation a little bit?
Boy, you got it right on the head, Paul, because there was a period where I think everybody became aware of how horrible the Nazis were when the Czechs had sent in a handful of, I guess you'd call them, assassins from England to get rid of a man named Heinrich, who was Heinrich the Hangman or something like that. And in retaliation, when the Germans found out that there was a Czech people, they picked out a village called Lidice, and they went into this little town, arrested all the people in this town, took the men and boys out and shot them in the street, in the field there, took all the women and girls to someplace out of Germany. They bulldozed the village, say that nobody would ever remember there was a Lidice. And but when that happened, of course, my parents from Czechoslovakia were just horrified by this. And, of course, I reacted in the same way. And when that happened, I guess there was about maybe four or five or six towns in the U.S. that renamed themselves Lidice so it would not be forgotten. So there was a special reason for me to want to go to Europe rather than the Pacific, was to get into after Hitler.
Well, man, I'm emotional just listening to you talk about that, and I can see how powerful that would have been for you. And I think that was a great on those American towns to rename themselves, and clearly that was a factor for you. When we come back, we're going to take our first commercial break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk about what you did in Europe and about the mother of all first missions, because I understand that's what you experienced in that B-24 over the skies of Europe. Frank Hoker, a former B-24 navigator and a prisoner of war, now a volunteer at the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno, our guest today. Don't forget to go to heroesofthevalley.com. Get your tickets now for next Sunday's fundraiser for the Veterans Memorial Museum. You're listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
That song before, and so is Frank Hoker. He's our guest today, World War II Army Air Corps veteran, also served in Korea. We're going to talk about that by the time the afternoon is done today. Want to remind you again to go see Frank next Sunday at the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno. That Heroes of the Valley fundraiser will be next Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. If you want to get your tickets now, you can call 559-323-9226. Or go to heroesofthevalley.com. It's a great cause, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the museum and how special it is to Frank a little later on in the program. For now, I want to get back to where we left off with Frank. He was heading over to Europe with the 461st Bomb Group of the 15th Air Force. And eventually, Frank, it came time for something you'd probably been looking forward to for a long time. You talked about how personal it was for you with your Czech heritage and what Hitler had done to the Czechs. Finally, you find out in December of 1944, you're going up in the sky on a bombing run. Walk us through what that felt like before, during, and after that mission. When did you realize that, here we go, here's the first one, and were you antsy at all about that?
It wasn't so much that we were scared or frightened. It was just kind of anticipation of doing the job. We trained in Arizona at Davis-Monthan in B-24s, and we were trained right up to the hilt, so we felt, God, we're ready to go. And when we got to Italy at the 461st, we flew about three or four local missions just to get familiar with the territory. And the day we were posted for it, our first mission, we weren't quite sure where we were going to be going. And when we came in for the briefing, up on the wall was this huge map and a big red line running from Italy clear up across Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, and almost to the border of Poland. It was a target called Odertal, and it was comparable in some ways to Ploesti. It was an oil refinery that had been hit two or three times before, and it was important that we knock out some of the fuel supplies for the German army, because that they felt that was the lifeblood of their army. Is, you know, they could not roll without fuel, so to hit Odertal was a very important target. We were told it might be a milk run because this was already late in the war. It was December of 44, and we were told, well, there might not be too many fighters. There'd be some flak. However, we were going to be in a fairly large formation. There, somewhere around 500 planes are going to be on this mission, B-24s and B-17s both. We would have some P-51s and P-38s as escort as far as they could go with their fuel tanks. and then into the target area we would be on our own. In this mission, I was placed on the flight deck where the radar operator would normally sit rather than being in the nose, because they changed the way that the people were assigned positions, and why they did this, I don't know, but I found myself rather than being in the nose in kind of an enclosed little compartment, so I didn't have a very good view outside the plane, so I could kind of observe where we were as a navigator. I just followed the map and the briefing session that we had and kind of pinpointed myself time-wise that we were somewhere over Czechoslovakia. So
you were a navigator flying blind.
A navigator flying blind in the one sense. All I had was my watch and maybe a compass and the map in front of me that said at such and such a time we should be in such and such a location. So I knew roughly where we were, but not exactly.
And of course, you had to maintain formation all this time anyway.
Right? Well, we were in this, we were the tail end Charlie in a flight of 7 planes. And there was, in our particular squadron, I think somewhere around 30 some odd planes that were flying in this box. And as I said, there were about 500 planes in the mission. They were going to attack actually 2 targets. One was Black Hammer, which was a manufacturing town, and the other one was the Odertal plant that I mentioned. And both of them were heavily defended. They were right together, and they were like 2 alternate targets. And about 20 or 30 minutes before we were supposed to be approaching the initial point, which is where you begin to line up for your bomb run, we begin to get flak. We could see it up ahead of you. I could hear it. To me, it sounded like somebody was throwing gravel on the side of our plane. It was just kind of little rattling sounds. But the difference was, in addition to the sound of the flak, you know, hitting our plane, was the fact that our plane was bouncing around like it suddenly hit some very violent up and down drafts, and that was the bomb explosions. I didn't realize at the time, but that's what I found out later on. And within a short time after we begin to encounter the flak, I heard the top turret gunner, Bob Trumpy, start shouting, "Bandits, bandits!" And so I jumped from my seat, looked out through the pilot's windshield ahead of me, and saw these 4 fighter planes coming in wingtip to wingtip straight at us, single-engine planes. And you could see little kind of sparkles along their wingtips, and you knew exactly what that was, right? That was my first encounter with seeing somebody firing at you. And I said, boy, this could be serious. And it was. I think I was more concerned about the fighter planes than I was the flak, because the fighter planes are specifically aiming at a specific plane, whereas the flak is in a general barrage. They just hope to hit some plane, whereas the fighter planes are going to hit a specific plane.
And it sounds like they had you exactly where they wanted you.
Right where they wanted to. We were under attack for about 7 to 10 minutes, it seemed like, with the fighter planes. And after about the third wave of them, the top turret gunner jumped down from his seat. He was right above me there where I was in the radar compartment, and yelled to the pilot that our left wing was on fire. So we knew that it was pretty much time to start getting ready to get out of there, because I had already looked out the little side window by my radio position there and saw 2 or 3 bombers just explode on either side of us. And a couple of them just didn't explode, but they just went down trailing smoke. So we were losing planes already before we ever got to the target area. So
it's not very reassuring, is it?
Well, it all happened so fast. I don't think you even had time to get... Well, I guess your adrenaline was flowing pretty fast. But you didn't have time to get scared, to be honest with you. It just happened so fast that you just continue doing what you're doing. I just wished I had a gun to shoot instead of having a pencil in my hand. A gun would have been more reassuring than having a 2B pencil to draw a map.
How long was it before you heard the order to bail out?
It was about 10 minutes after the top turret gunner called out the fire on the wingtip. He was afraid that it could get to the fuel cells, because there was fuel in the wings, and he said, "We'll blow up if we don't get out of here pretty soon." And the pilot told him to get back up in the turret, keep shooting at the planes, that he would try to get the fire out. They had, I guess, like fire extinguishers. We had one engine that was already knocked out with the turbocharger that was knocked out by the flak, so we were starting to lose position in the formation. And as soon as you drop out of formation, then you're a sitting duck for the fighter planes that come in and pick you off as the stray sheep. So it was like just a matter of minutes. I can't tell you whether it was 10, 15, or 3 minutes. It was just, it happened so fast. And the next thing you know, the pilot's saying, he didn't say anything. He just hit the bell, and it rang through the whole ship, and everybody knew it's time to get out of there. And at this point, Trumpy, who was the top turret gunner, and the engineer, Heimbaugh, were trying to open the bomb bay doors, but apparently something had damaged the hydraulic system. They tried jumping on them to loosen the bomb bay doors, and those didn't open right away. So Heimbaugh, the engineer, got off to one side of the bomb bay and started to turn a crank that opened the doors manually. And Trumpy, who was the top turret gunner, and Heimbaugh, the engineer, they went out. I didn't have a regular chute on. I had a chest pack that was off to one side of my compartment there. So I grabbed the chute, hooked it onto the harness. It was a chest pack. And when I bailed out, the chute didn't open. I had pulled the ripcord out, and I saw I had like about a one-inch piece of wire hanging from the D-ring, and the rest of the wire, the release of the chute, was still in the chute.
Oh, no.
So I remember opening the snaps on the front of the chute, pulling the retaining pins out of the chute, throwing them away, and then pulling out the pilot chute. When the chute opened up, it was full of holes, so I came down pretty fast, but fortunately, I was not very big. And
well, you just described all that pretty matter-of-factly, but everything that you're describing is happening as you're plummeting toward the Earth out of a B-24, right?
It seemed like it took forever, Paul.
Holy cow.
It happens very fast, but I think when your mind is pumped up with adrenaline, you probably, it's like when a mother sees her baby, you know, under a car like that, and a little lady can pick up a car and get her baby out. Something like that happened, I guess, in this case here, too. You don't think about it. You just do it.
So your first chute, you can't open it all. You open up the backup chute. It has holes in it.
The backup chute has full of holes because the pack was sitting off to one side, and when the chute opened, it revealed where the flak had come through and cut my the D-ring connection. Mm-hmm. So if it hadn't been a backpack, I'd have never made it. I wouldn't be here telling you the story.
Wow. And as it was, you came down pretty fast.
Came down pretty fast. And again, I guess I should tell you, I'm a believer because I think God was looking out for me, because when I came down, I landed in a bunch of tall pine trees. And as I crashed through the trees, I didn't hit any limbs that injured me like that, but the chute got snarled up in the top of these trees, the top of one tree, I guess, and slowed me down enough so that I never touched the ground. I stopped about maybe 2 or 3 feet above the ground, bouncing like on a bungee cord, literally. But apparently...
And that's not how you practiced it, huh?
It wasn't. We have a book called Not As Brief that someday I could like to show you, but it's basically, it's not what they told you was going to happen. Something that happens unexpectedly, not as briefed.
So you end up suspended a couple feet above the ground, and you're instantly saying, thank you, Lord, huh?
Exactly. I wasn't much of a religious man at that time, but it kind of grew on me in a hurry from that point on.
But pretty soon you were hearing some other words in a thick German accent, because how long was it before you were discovered there?
I was still hanging in the tree trying to get out of my harness when these guys came up this snowy slope and pointing rifles at me and moistening me for to come down. I don't know if this actually happened. It's something that all the guys that were in prison camp seem to say happened to them, that when they were first captured, the German guard that caught them says, for you, the war is over. And I think that's what he said to me, but I'm not sure. But it seems to be a story that so many guys told, but it must be partially true.
Well, I think that was in their manual. That was one of the English phrases they had to learn. If you find one of these guys, here's what you say.
The war is over for you.
What's going through your head in a moment like that? Are you relieved that you're alive? Are you intimidated that you're captured and you don't know what's going to happen to you? Is it a mixture of both?
I think at the moment, well, I'm very young. I don't know a heck of a lot. I'm very cocky about this because, you know, I'm an American flyer. We're invincible. And all of a sudden the tables are turned, and now I'm wondering, what the heck's going to happen to me? Also, the thing that passed through my mind, where's the rest of my crew? Because we were very close. We had named our crew the 10 men back, with the idea that when we left, there would be 10 of us going to combat, and when we returned, there would be 10 men back from combat. Well, in the attack, The ball turret gunner was killed during the attack, so he never left the plane. And there's a story that goes with that, too, which, if you want, I'll tell that one to you later on.
All right. And I imagine as fast as you came down, with the first chute not working, the second one being full of holes, you didn't have much time to look around and see what was happening to the plane and if it exploded or what.
When my chute did open, I could see the plane disappearing into the clouds below, because we were above the clouds when this happened. And I saw the plane kind of tipping over with a long plume of fire coming off the wing. At this point, I don't remember whether it was right or left. I noticed the left wing, but I don't recall that in my mind. But I do recall that I saw the plane kind of in a steep bank, heading through the clouds and going down with the flames coming from behind the plane by maybe 30 or 40 feet longer than the plane itself was. But I did not see any chutes, so I didn't know if I was the only one that jumped out or, you know, if I was among the others who'd survived. So I didn't find that out till much later. I was the only guy for quite a while that I was by myself for quite a while, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, and we'll build a little suspense here. We'll let the listeners wait till we come back to find out how many did get out of the plane and what happened to you after you were captured and they said, for you, the war is over. This show is far from over, just about halfway through with Hometown Heroes this afternoon, and we'll be right back with more with Frank Hoker today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
And here I stay within my lonely room, 'cause I don't wanna walk without you, baby. Walk without
me. Been a while since most of you have heard that song, way back when, during World War II. Our guest today, Frank Hoker, sure remembers it, and he remembers a lot of things about not just World War II, but the Korean conflict as well, where he actually saw a little more action than he did in World War II. And the reason for that, you heard about his very first mission in the skies over Europe as a B-24 navigator in December of 1944. His plane was shot down. You heard about him jumping from the plane. His first parachute didn't work. The backup chute had holes in it from all the flak that had hit him. But thanks to that chute catching on some trees, he ended up suspended a couple feet over ground, was quickly captured by German troops. And then they made you move a little bit, right, Frank? Where did they take you once you're in captivity?
Well, strangely enough, I was captured in a little town near Trenčín, Czechoslovakia, which was actually in what is now Slovakia. And we were there for about 1 or 2 days. They moved us down to a little village closer to the main town of Trenčín, and then from there we went down to Vienna, from Vienna to a town called Wetzlar. In Wetzlar we were shipped off to Frankfurt for interrogation, and from Frankfurt then we were assigned to a Stalag, which kind of assigned us to different German POW camps, and we wound up in Stalag 1, which is on the on the Baltic, just in the northern part of Germany, right off of Denmark.
How was the interrogation for you?
The first part of it was just routine. They want to know, you know, where we were coming from, what our squadron was. We stuck to the regime of just name, rank, and serial number, not telling them anything. But they knew who we were, because when they shot our plane down, the plane had markings, which I quickly identified our organization as the 461st. And when I got to Frankfurt, however, there I was kept in a solitary confined cell for about 3 or 4 days, brought out, and some German officer brought me into his room, into an office, and behind him was a bookshelf, was about like 6 or 8 feet tall, with volumes and volumes of books. He looked on a piece of paper on his desk, said, Lieutenant Hoker, let's see here, I've got this information here. He reached up on the bookshelf, pulled out a huge book, opened it up to a certain page. He said, you went to basic training at Santa Maria. You were at Davis-Monthan for B-24 training, and you were assigned to the 461st Bomb Group in Italy, and you were on a target to Odertal. Is there anything else you'd like to correct in those statements? He had it all there, and I was astounded, but apparently the Germans had an incredible clipping service that clipped when you graduated from when you graduated from military school, when you wherever you were assigned, because our public relations people were so great on putting information like that in the newspapers, and of course they picked it all up and put it into a binder, and it'd been like about 2 weeks since I'd been captured when I got to this situation where the German officer was interviewing me. They had time to track me down and find out who I was. So it sounds a little
unnerving, though, when they know more about you than you know about yourself.
Because your mouth drops open, you're saying, what else do they know? And so there's no point in saying name, rank, and serial number. You can't tell them anything. Besides, as I told you earlier, Paul, this is my first mission. I know nothing.
Probably a good thing.
Like Schultz, I know nothing.
Well, and speaking of Schultz, that sitcom, I'm sure, would be a little different for you, speaking of Hogan's Heroes, of course, than for most Americans, because you actually lived in a prisoner of war camp. Probably wasn't exactly like the one depicted on Hogan's Heroes, though.
No, I think there was a movie, Stalag 17, that more approximately gave you a picture of what a Stalag would be like. We didn't have quite the sophisticated intelligence setup that they had in Stalag 17, but we did have a concealed radio that was apparently not found by the Germans. Some of the guys were clever enough to make a map of Europe from memory, and we had a large battle map that showed where the Russians were, where the British and American forces were on the battle map. And because the little concealed radio we had was able to pick up BBC news, we had more accurate information than what the Germans were giving us off of their particular information. And as a matter of fact, every day they would circulate a little piece of typewritten paper that was run off on a mimeograph. I don't know how we did this, but we did in the prison camp, that was called the powwow, prisoners of war without women, I guess. Anyways, the powwow was a little
had to remind yourselves
for
of that, huh?
Exactly. And in the paper, it would tell what was happening in the Russian front, what was happening in the Western front. And we had relatively accurate information almost every day as to how the battles were going. The day I was shot down was the day after the Battle of the Bulge began, so there was a lot of activity going on throughout the European theater, and December 17th was the day after the Battle of the Bulge began, so we were hitting the Germans from above, because we couldn't see the ground to bring planes down the deck, because if you remember, the Battle of the Bulge was clouded over so badly that the fighter planes couldn't help the guys who were at Bastogne, so all we could do was drop bombs through the clouds from above. And that was kind of what we felt, you know, something was happening good to keep our morale up, is that we would get the news from BBC of how the war was progressing, so we never lost our confidence in the, you know, ultimate victory of the Allied forces.
That said, given the time of year and not the luxury accommodations, I imagine it was pretty cold. You didn't have much to eat. You ate things you never imagined eating before. This wasn't a picnic.
To this day, I can't stand the cold very well. I can stand your Fresno heat better than I can stand the cold. It was one of the coldest winters, I think, in Europe in a long time, and we were quite affected by it, especially in prison camp. We had a little tiny stove in our room. There was about 24 men in each room in the barracks that they kept us confined in. But the trouble was there was no fuel for it, so we had to resort to ripping out wooden planks from either the flooring or the ceiling of the barracks we were in to use as fuel. So little by little, we were cannibalizing the very buildings we were in to keep the room warm where we were being held prisoner. So that and of course you mentioned the food. I never knew what a rutabaga or a kohlrabi was until I ate some, and we made stew out of them basically. We made little like pots or pans out of the tin cans we got. We pound up tin cans flat and then weld them together to make a little bit larger pots and pans. And we would cook our meals in these kind of Yankee ingenuity kitchen utensils. They were good enough to hold water long enough to cook the meals in them. And basically potatoes, a lot of cabbage. I had so much cabbage, I couldn't believe it. But it's okay, because as a Bohemian, I grew up on sauerkraut and roast pork and dumplings, so it wasn't all that bad for me.
How much weight did you lose?
If I think back now, I think I lost about 35, 40 pounds, somewhere in there. I was relatively thin. I had to get all new clothes when I came back to the service, because my old uniforms didn't fit me. Most of the stuff that I had been shipped back to the States after our crew was shot down. And we got new clothes that were a little bit smaller around the waist, especially.
Now, and you guys would be liberated eventually in May. In fact, about this time of the year, back
exactly.
in 1945, that camp was finally liberated. And the Russians, as I understand, actually wanted to take you in the other direction, but through the intervention of one of the great fighter aces in American history, Hub Zemke, I understand that it was negotiated the Americans could be taken out to Camp Lucky Strike and then sent home. Before we get to all that, I don't want to leave our listeners hanging. We left them hanging in the commercial break about how many people got out of the plane, and when you found out that you weren't the only one, did that happen while you're in POW camp or not until after that?
It happened almost immediately afterwards. After I was captured, I was taken into this little village, and the local police really were the ones who captured, who had control of me, threw me into what looked like a little vegetable cellar, a vegetable bin under a building, under a house, and I was in there for about an hour and a half or 2 hours. Somebody brought in a little bowl of soup, like a cabbage soup or something. And about an hour after that, they brought in my pilot, Ken Smith. And about 2 hours after that, they brought in the bombardier. And apparently, one by one, they were rounding up the rest of the crew. And two of the men were injured so badly, they were taken immediately to a hospital down in near Bratislava, near Trenčín. And there was one man that never showed up. That was our nose gunner, Ed Burkhart. When he bailed out, he landed apparently on the other side of a mountain from where the rest of the crew had been captured, and he was picked up by partisans. So he never did get captured. He spent the rest of the war going up and down the hills with that the partisans had, and he did not do any of the what shall I say, destructive work, but his job was to carry the heavy-duty stuff that the Russians wanted him to carry. So we found out that one man had died in the plane when it crashed, and the Germans notified us of that and said that he had been buried near that town there of Trenčínske Teplice, and that there was a marker for his grave. So we apparently had lost only one man during the crash of our bomber.
Well, and I understand that years later you were able to reunite with some of those guys, and I want to get to that story when we get back. The time goes by too quickly on these shows sometimes, and that's the case today. There's still a lot to cover with Frank Hoker, his time in the air over Korea, what he does at the Veterans Memorial Museum now. Don't forget to go to heroesofthevalley.com to get your tickets for next week's fundraiser. And we'll also talk about just how he got in touch again with some of the members of his crew, and I think this story will really throw you for a loop. It's one of those small world connections that's almost hard to believe. That's up next when Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lafler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I know I say this every week, but the time goes way too fast. So let's get right back to it with Frank Hoker. Won't have a whole lot of time to talk about his experiences in Korea. You heard he was shot down on his first mission in World War II. He did go on to partake in 67 missions in Korea as a navigator, and we thank him for his service in that conflict. Back to World War II and the crew that you talked about, Frank. You called it 10 men back. It ended up being 9 men back. One was killed on the plane. But years later, you're watching television, and there's a sports announcer on NBC by the name of Bob Trumpy. And that, I guess, rang a bell for you?
That was a mind blower, because the top turret gunner, who was the armor for our plane, was named Bob Trumpy, And I didn't know much about Bob's youth, but I did know that he played football. And I kept seeing Bob Trumper's name appearing on the NBC sports specials, both for golf and for football. And I also remember Bob Trumpy being a wide receiver for the Cincinnati Bengals, and this drove me crazy. So one day in the paper, I saw a picture of Bob and a couple of his co-hosts for one of the sports shows. So I made a copy of my crew picture with Bob, his face circled in the picture, and sent it to NBC, care of Bob Trumpy, NBC. And within about 2 weeks, I got a call back. It was late in the evening, and it was Bob Trumpy Sr. said, "Frank, that's my son. How have you been?" We started talking, and it had been almost 40 years since we had seen each other. But from that conversation, we decided to get together with the rest of the crew if there's any possibility. And we did have a reunion almost 40 years to the day after we'd been shot down for the first time. And it was unbelievable. Not all of us were there, of course, because a few of us were already gone, but we had seven of the original crew together for a dinner in Springfield, Illinois. And
wow.
From that point on, we've met several more times, including a reunion that took us back to Czechoslovakia and a visit to the actual site where our bomber crashed.
Wow. And none of that would have happened if you didn't see this guy on TV and send him a letter.
If it hadn't have been for this guy playing football for the Cincinnati Bengals and the name being the same, I had to follow up on that. There was no other way to just, I couldn't let it go.
Well, and Bob Trumpy, the announcer, I guess never would have been here if his dad didn't get home from the war.
That's very true. And Bob was a very special guy in his own right. I'm talking about the father now. Came back from the war, went to school on the GI Bill, became a teacher, became the principal, and also wrote a lot of funny poems that could not be repeated on the air.
So. Well, I'm glad you didn't bring them with you. We're getting tight on time, less than 3 minutes left in the show, and I wish I would have saved a little more time for this, but tell me about the Veterans Memorial Museum. What do you get out of it as a volunteer? Why do you go down there, and why do you think people need to get out and support it this next weekend?
I became a volunteer there when the POWs needed some free picture frames made. I went down to see if we could have some picture frames made. They said, yeah, but you'll have to make them yourself. I happen to have worked at Aaron Brothers learning picture framing when I retired, and they said, we can use your talent. So they put me to work at the Memorial Auditorium there at, well, actually it's the Veterans Museum. And those guys are all volunteers now who are trying to keep alive the tradition, the history, the heritage of our country, to show what kind of sacrifice it took to make this a free country. And we try to preserve that to the best of our ability. We always welcome young people, students who come there as groups or individuals come by, or some old veterans who come by to see if they can find something about their old outfit or places that they had been. The place is a veritable gem, but it's not that well known in the city, and we'd like to have everybody come down and look at the museum. Admission is free, by the way, which is a great plus.
For the museum, yes, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 3 o'clock, and it's free. The fundraiser on May 25th, there is a fee for that, $15, but it goes to a great cause to keeping that museum up, keeping these displays going. And remember, this is all volunteer work, people like Frank who are donating their time to try to keep, like he says, this legacy alive. And if you go into the Prisoner of War room at the museum, you see a good-looking young guy out of Cicero, huh? Is your picture on the wall in there?
Well, actually, it's so good-looking, I can't believe it's me.
Well, I'll take your word for it. How's that?
Thank you, sir.
Frank, looking back, we have less than a minute in the show, but looking back, what are you most thankful for about what you were able to do in the service during World War II?
Well, I feel very proud of having served the country, wearing the uniform. Every morning when I get up, I go out in the front of my house, put up the American flag. I don't salute it. I don't have to, but to me, that's representing something very special in this world, a country that's dedicated to liberty and freedom. And I think that's something that is so precious that we should never, never feel bad about sacrificing for that liberty and freedom.
Amen.
Everybody should have that.
Amen and amen. And Frank, thank you very much for your service to our country then and now. And in your mother tongue, I can say, Dziękuję moc krát.
Radosy stala chlapcze.
And I don't understand that part, but I said thank you many times if you didn't understand at home. That's it for Hometown Heroes today. News Talk 580 KMJ.